Lowe's knows laundry day should be easy. Achieve maximum versatility with a dryer door that swings open either way, making load transfer from washer to dryer a breeze. Plus, with LG ThinQ, save time by controlling your washer remotely. Shop LG, America's most reliable line of home appliances, today at Lowe's. Based on independent reliability surveys 2021 to 2024 and select major appliances as compared to competing manufacturers offering full appliance lines. See associate for more details. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, exclusions apply. Valid 6/18 through 7/9.
Hey everybody, it's Kate.
And Devin.
Welcome to Christmas Med Crimes.
That was backwards.
Sorry.
Different. I missed my welcome to Med Crimes.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. You're allowed.
We switch it around. I feel like we switch it around. Not at all. Usually I make you do it. Yeah.
Just like I make you do all the stories.
Listen, you can say Med Crimes. That's your only job. You just got to show up and say Med Crimes.
I love my job.
I know. It's so easy. We hope you're all having a happy and safe holiday season because we're having a great one.
It's a few days before Christmas. Here we go, not talking again.
Hey, Devin, take a deep breath.
It's a few days.
Thank you.
Before Christmas right now. Mm-hmm. This episode's coming out right after Christmas.
Yep.
We hope you all had a wonderful holiday. I hope you're enjoying some family time, had some good food, got to give and receive some wonderful gifts. I think before we get too into it, Kate and I want to make an announcement.
Yep.
We are taking a brief hiatus. Brief. Sorry for all of our fans out there that are right now going, just for the month of January.
Yes.
We will be back the first Tuesday in February.
We will.
Right? First Tuesday?
We'll be back and better than ever.
We will be back. Mm-hmm. We've just, as we've mentioned in some other little banter times, have some employment changes coming up and some just different things and going on with both Kate and I. So just a brief little 30-day break.
Yep. Also, I just wanted to point out that right before we started recording, Devin presented me with this beautiful gift. It was beautifully wrapped. And I just looked at her and went, I ordered your gift and the gift's for the boys and it hasn't even come in the mail yet because the shipment's been delayed and I was so frustrated about it. But she got me like this gorgeous bag that is totally me and I love it. So thank you.
It's been 17 years of friendship. I know what you like.
Yeah. And I know that you're always going to be the friend that shows up prepared with a beautifully wrapped gift. And I'm always going to be the one that goes,
I'm such a planner.
You are.
I don't like when things don't go as planned.
I mean, same. That's why I'm like annoyed right now that your gift is not here.
Honey,
so.
You are my gift. So much love.
Stick a bow on me.
Wrap it up. That's probably what other people are saying. Enough. Wrap it up.
All right. So
we have Kristen part two.
We do. And we'll talk a little bit about where we left off. So.
Brief synopsis.
Kristen was a smart, talented kid who spent her childhood following her father's esteemed teaching and political career pretty much all over the country. When a devastating injury effectively ended her dance career, she turned to hard drugs. And her drug of choice was crystal methamphetamine. And she had tried to get clean a number of times, finally being successful after she met a kind stranger named Greg DeVillers in Tijuana. And she, from there, excelled in science and went back to school, eventually began working as a toxicologist at the medical examiner's office. And unfortunately, in that role, with the consistent exposure to hard drugs in the office, she relapsed, began stealing drugs from work. And where we left off was Greg catches her in an affair with her boss and threatens to collapse like the entire success that she built. And unfortunately, Kristen panics and her actions take a very sinister turn at this point.
So we basically stopped when the shit hit the fan.
Kinda.
And I was left hanging from said fan.
You're welcome.
For 2 weeks.
She's been on the fan for 2 weeks.
Spinning and spinning and spinning.
Anyway, let's get Devin off the fan, everybody. So, trigger warning here because we are going to be discussing some themes of suicide. Back to November 2nd of the year 2000. Kristen and Greg are having that discussion about the affair. Kristen, during this discussion, shared that she felt like she was in love with Dr. Robertson, and she asked Greg for a trial separation. Greg continued to want to fight for their future. He also felt very hurt, given how he had supported the shit out of Kristen through the throes of her addiction and essentially pushed her to be, like, the successful woman that she is now. He changed her life for the better, 100%.
And every time she kept screwing him over and over and over again, he just kept forgiving her and forgiving her, which is a very loving thing in some way.
I mean, I think that, and we talked about it in the first episode, but
also you deserve better, dude.
Oh, 100% he deserves better. I just think he did not want to fall into the same pattern that his dad left. You know what I mean? I think that his dad leaving him at an early age really left that huge impression on him. And he just was so committed to staying in this relationship, I think, for that reason.
I mean, let's not be honest. Greg, I can relate.
Yeah.
Been there, man.
Yes, exactly. It's
better on the other side.
It is so much better, Greg, on the other side. You do not need this in your life. So at this point, they had been together almost 5 years. So, like, I also get to, you know, the sensation of feeling invested in something and not wanting to, you know, have that feeling of having thrown that all away. So all understandable feelings. Now, neighbors in the apartment complex noted that during this time when Kristen would, like, come and go from the apartment complex, she would seem standoffish, unapproachable, irritable, like she had just left in a huff, sort of all the time. And they also heard nearly nightly fights between the two. Her co-workers began to notice a change as well, because we had talked about how her affair was an existing rumor at the workplace, but her behavior was starting to change too. And a drug relapse, they didn't really know about her past, so they didn't really suspect that, but they just, she was, like, being found alone in some of those lab ventilation rooms, and people were like, that's, you know, that's odd. People found that odd. And she also spent, like, a lot of time away from her desk. So they were just like, where the hell's Kristen? Like, what is she doing? She should be here at her desk. Like, what else could she be doing? And at this point, she was probably getting high.
It's like, hey, lady, you have a job.
Yeah, exactly. But I think she was going there, like, for the purpose to, like, steal drugs. You know, probably not be that productive.
You know, when I was re-listening to the first time, I mean, yes, I have to listen to myself talk at least once. And I listened to the episode just one time.
Yeah.
But I was re-listening and I was like, okay, so I know I had asked the question about, you know, how she takes these drugs, right? Because, and she's the one that's responsible for logging them in.
Yes.
I really, and I know it was in the 90s, I really hope that now that is a two-person step process.
I should imagine that they've made a lot of changes since then. I mean,
it's 30 years, so I'm like, yeah, please tell me.
I should hope so. That's a great question. If that is
still the practice in this drug epidemic we have,
I can't imagine that it would be anymore. But please, if anybody works in this field and knows the process, let us know. Because we really sure as hell
hope that's not the case anymore.
I should hope that it involves more than one person so that you have that witness and that backup to back up your license. That's all very important stuff. So one day, her boss and new side piece, Dr. Robertson, found some meth hidden in her desk, like in a drawer. Now, drugs would often cross her desk, but them being found just, like, loosely in her drawer would have been very unusual.
Right.
So he actually took the little baggie and he himself tested it and confirmed what it was. He kind of told Kristen that he saw it. So he was now aware that she, like, had this drug use issue. On November 4th, Greg and Kristen were together all day. Greg and Kristen. They had fought most of the time. Kristen asked later in the day if they could cook dinner together, which they did. After dinner, they were watching a movie, and Kristen offered to make Greg a gin and tonic, which he took. That night, Greg fell asleep very quickly, and in the morning, he woke up, and having slept, you know, 14 or 16 hours and been like, wow.
Well, that's weird.
And he actually had called his brother. He had a younger brother named Jerome. So he reached out and he called his brother Jerome. And this is the following day. So this is November 5th. he said to his brother over the phone, like, oh, man, you know, Kristen made me a drink last night. It must have been really strong because I passed out for like 14 hours. So his like,
you know, she made me a drink. We were trying, you know, watching a movie.
Exactly. Exactly. Like, maybe this was actually a nice interaction for once. So his brother didn't really think anything of this at this time. And the two kind of went on into the discussion about, like, a snowboarding trip.
The brother was who they lived with in the beginning, right? Didn't he? He lived with someone, or he had roommates.
So he had roommates. It wasn't his brother.
But it wasn't the brother.
No. Okay. No. Okay. He had different roommates, not the brother.
Okay.
So
do you think he knew about her drug addiction?
So I don't think any of his family
That's what
knew.
I was like.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't think they did. I think he kind of kept that very much Got a it. Secret. So the two then kind of discussed this snowboard trip that was supposed to take place the following month in December. And his brother seemed normal and himself. They were making plans. They were, you know, talking about like buying tickets to places. Oh, so on the evening of the 5th, Kristen and Greg again fought because Kristen again brought up the subject of maybe doing a trial separation. So Greg was probably stewing and, like, angry about this. Every time she brought up the split, Greg threatened to reveal the drug use and her relationship with Robertson to their superiors, which would be devastating on so many levels for both of them. Mm-hmm. So Kristen at this point is likely feeling trapped in this marriage that she no longer really wants because Greg would not agree to a separation. So that night, as Greg slept, Kristen placed a call to Robertson.
That's me. That was me.
I thought that was a dog.
No. Sorry. That's me going, oh, here it comes.
Oh, that was amazing.
Here's what she did.
It's very long and drawn out. Don't brace yourself. You'll get exhausted. So so that night, as Greg slept, Kristen, at some point, placed a call to Robertson on a prepaid cell phone. The call lasted about 2 minutes. We don't know exactly what was said on that call, for sure, but it's kind of conspicuous that it was made at this time of day.
Is the fact that it's a prepaid phone a big deal?
It's a little weird because of the events that follow.
Okay.
So the most plausible theory is the following. So in the early AM hours of November 6th, so this is the following day, Kristen drugged Greg with massive doses of clonazepam, which is a benzodiazepine commonly used to treat anxiety, and oxycodone, which is an opioid analgesic. The delivery methods of these drugs are not known, but they were later found in Greg's system, so we do know that at some point he did take them. Okay. By the early morning hours of November 6th, Greg was likely nearing an unresponsive state if he wasn't already there. Kristen went to work briefly that morning, making small talk with coworkers and upholding the illusion that everything was absolutely fine. She was there only briefly, and it is suspected that Kristen stole fentanyl patches and vials of fentanyl from work at this time. She returned home around 10 a.m. Greg, being already unconscious, was given fentanyl, standard fentanyl, along with probably a huge number of fentanyl patches. By Kristen. It's not known for sure how many were used and what the exact doses were.
So she obviously put them on him and then at some point took them off.
Yep. So an audit that was performed later by the ME's office of their compounds, and we'll talk about that piece a little bit more, but they had identified that 15 fentanyl patches and 10,000 micrograms of fentanyl were unaccounted for.
10,000.
So she potentially stole that much fentanyl.
Jesus.
Yeah. So
that's a lot.
Fentanyl is a powerful opioid analgesic. We've talked about it on the show before. It is a drug that's habit forming, and when given in excess, can cause respiratory depression and death very easily. Fentanyl patches in particular are engineered to deliver a continuous lower dose of fentanyl over about a period of 72 hours. And typically these are used to treat chronic severe pain, such as cancer related pain. Kristen probably realized that it would be much easier for her to put a shitload of fentanyl patches on Greg in lieu of having to dose him multiple times, a la Jolly Jane.
Because the patches, do you explain this or am I interjecting?
No, go ahead, please.
The patches work like an extended release.
Yeah, exactly.
So
right.
By having the patch on your skin, it's just almost like seeping into your subcutaneous tissue your fat tissue.
That's exactly
right. And so it just goes over, and one patch will last for 72 hours.
Exactly right.
So you don't, you know, it's taking all that meds a little at a time.
Yeah, exactly right. But if you use way more than the normal dose of fentanyl patches, word.
And 15
getting,
patches at a time,
yeah, would be a just an absolutely astronomical continuous dose.
Normally, it's like good for chronic pain to keep
great.
It at a level,
exactly.
And it's an
That's
excellent
manageable.
Source
yes.
to do it that way.
Yes, exactly.
And just kind of always keep the chronic pain at bay.
Right. Exactly.
But when you have 15 on at one time, mm-hmm. my lordy.
Yeah. November 6th, still, this is November 6th, Greg's office receives a call from Kristen telling them that Greg will be out sick for a few days and to not expect him back in the next several days.
Or ever.
Kristen was then next seen by her apartment complex manager between 12 and 1 p.m.
Okay.
Scurrying back to the apartment.
Scurrying,
like walking hurriedly, apparently. So not running, but like beep, like oh, I'm
like,
kind of rushing. Yep, yep, yep. So she was seen scurrying back to her apartment, with some grocery bags in tow, or like a grocery bag.
She was hungry.
Well, she had bought a few grocery items, and it's suspected that at this point she may have administered more fentanyl or put on more patches or what have you. She did, from here, after that, stop briefly back at work, then met up with Robertson and spent most of the afternoon with him. Now, while she was at work for that brief time, her coworkers later said again, she was very unassuming, didn't give any impression that she was stressed or that anything was wrong. She seemed very much herself.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that she kept leaving and coming and going wasn't alarming. So, right? So this kind of tells me she did this all the time.
So most likely. And also because Kristen was like so flighty recently and like disappearing from her desk all the time, spending time like being found in random rooms, like, you know, this sounds like her not being accounted for periods of time during the day was not all that unusual.
Right. Because that is an unusual behavior.
Yes.
If it's not your norm.
If it's not your norm.
Popping in and out of the workday.
Exactly.
You're right.
Exactly. So this is what happened according to Kristen. She stayed with Robertson until about 5 p.m. She left him around 5 p.m. to go run some errands. She then returned to the apartment around 8 p.m., her own apartment that she shares with Greg. She states that he seemed sound asleep and that she kissed him on the forehead, went into the bathroom and took a long bath, shaved her legs, like did the whole, you know, self-care thing.
Who got time for that?
Nobody with children, that's for sure. Then when she came back into the room, into their bedroom, and she found that Greg was not breathing and he was ice cold to the touch. Mm. Now, that night, which again, November 6th, the year 2000, at 9:22 p.m., the San Diego Emergency Dispatch receives a call from a frantically panicked Kristen Rossum. Kristen states that the previous day, Greg had been feeling unwell and sleeping a lot, but now he's not waking up and he had stopped breathing. So EMS was dispatched to the home, and the dispatcher instructed Kristen to perform rescue breathing and chest compressions. Kristen stated to the dispatcher that she was performing CPR during this call. Now, EMS walked in to find Kristen in the living room, like looking out the window, you know, trying to, you know, wave them into the door. And she had the phone to her ear. She was talking to the dispatcher still, looking very distraught. And they enter the bedroom to find Greg on the floor of their bedroom. Now, I found some sources stating that he was found in the bed, others stating that he was on the floor. According to the court documents, though, he was found by EMS on the floor.
Okay.
Yeah. So.
So EMS didn't find him on the floor. They're saying that
No, EMS found him on the floor. EMS took very quick action. He was intubated there and they started an IV. They did some other resuscitative measures. Police had arrived as well and were starting to do sort of an investigation of the scene. Greg was found surrounded by rose petals, reminiscent of the film American Beauty.
I never saw that.
You didn't?
No.
It's a great movie. You should see it. Beside his head was a photo of the two of them, like a happy couple photo.
So she's making this look like a suicide.
Yeah, my God, yes. So hold on.
Did I just blow it?
Yeah. Well, no.
It's a given. Like, he's so heartbroken.
I know, exactly. And then also near his body was an open journal of Kristen's, which contained multiple entries about her unhappiness in the marriage and her affair.
She's playing this up.
So, all very carefully staged to look like a suicide. Kristen starts telling police how Greg had been drinking heavily of late, and she also told them that he had taken some of her clonazepam and oxycodone, and that she had been prescribed these medications several years ago for withdrawal symptoms when she was trying to get off of drugs. Yeah. Which
that, not so much the oxy.
Well, sometimes, because you can have body aches and pain for that. Now, she was concerned that he intentionally overdosed, and she had asked for, because she had like asked for that trial separation, and he did not take it well. So initially, investigators weren't overly suspicious because the story, you know, seemed to fit the scene on first glance. Greg was rushed to the hospital, where unfortunately he was pronounced dead despite the heroic efforts of the EMS and hospital staff there. He died at 10:19 p.m., or actually he was pronounced dead at 10:19 p.m. Kristen, of course, had gone to the hospital and was in the waiting area. And nurses recall that when she heard of Greg's death, she was appropriately upset, but seemed very close with the man that accompanied her to the hospital, who was Dr. Robertson. Kristen called her mom and informed her mom of Greg's death, and she had told her mom that she thought that Greg had had a reaction to cough syrup that he took when he wasn't feeling well.
What?
Which was an entirely different story that she gave investigators. So she, you know, Kristen was acting like she was beside herself, so her mom volunteered to call Greg's family and notify them. So her mom, Constance, is the one that notified Greg's family of his passing. Wow. And of course they were utterly devastated.
Of course. Absolutely. Yeah, of course.
Of course.
Especially for them, this is out of the blue because this was not his nature.
Well, exactly. But, and we'll talk more about that too. So at the hospital, you know, after things calm down a bit, Kristen signs papers to have his organs donated, which is not uncommon. And they do often have to act kind of quickly after a death like this in order to potentially harvest organs. Because as many organ tissues can't be procured after a certain amount of time after death. There are tissues that can be donated a little longer after death, like corneas, eyeballs, skin, bone, tendon.
Because I was about to say, like, too much time has passed for the big stuff.
Right, like the heart, liver, the lungs, kidneys.
This is too long.
Yes, most likely. So,
and especially if he suffered a cardiac death, like, which he did, essentially. So you can't donate them anyway, regardless of the time.
They
right?
may have been able to if he had gotten there very quickly.
Right.
And
right.
they're screened very carefully. But Kristen was not made aware that he was outside the timeline. And she most likely breathed a sigh of relief, thinking that Greg's organs would be harvested.
And all separated, because that's all evidence.
And because she's a toxicologist and she knows that a lot of sampling of these organs are what is necessary to test for the metabolites of certain drugs. So like she wants to send them away.
Put them in someone else.
So she's thinking, great, they're donated. They're going to be in other people. No one's ever going to be able to test those organs. So she didn't realize that the absence of certain organs would not completely hinder the medical examiner's office determining the cause of death. But even if he hadn't had those organs, they probably would have still been able to figure it out. But regardless, he kept the major organs because he was outside that timeline.
Yeah, yeah.
But she didn't know this. So detectives, meanwhile, while she's at the hospital, are processing the scene. And they're looking at the diary. They're looking at these rose petals and the picture of the couple. And they find this crumpled up love letter from Robertson next to the bed. And, excuse me, they also found this bottle of cold medicine that was completely empty in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
So detectives are starting to look at everything and be like, well, this is very theatrical. And this is literally out of a fucking movie. Like, nothing.
It's so dramatized.
It's so dramatized, right. And so very much out of a movie.
Because it's all laid out there for him. Look at me. Come find me.
Nothing is ever that perfect. No. And just like, it didn't quite sit right. Like, there was something just obviously very bizarre about this whole thing. It was just a little too perfect.
I'm going to have to go watch American Beauty.
Yes, you are. Okay. You are. So when she arrives back at her home during this ongoing investigation, she arrives with Robertson in tow, which immediately make them start asking some more questions.
This guy's not leaving. He's not just comforting her at the hospital. He's like, he's still around,
accompanying her home. So what's all this about? So she again reviews her day with the detectives starting in the morning. She states that when she came home midday with groceries in tow, it was because she wanted to have lunch with Greg. Fine. She stated that at the time, he wasn't feeling well and that he seemed very sleepy and that she had suspected that he had taken some of those meds that she had said before. So she recanted how she recalled how Greg had been upset regarding her request for the separation, and she didn't say it outright, but she implied that Greg died by suicide, which obviously the whole scene sort of
she was leading
that.
Him that way. Yeah.
So continuing the search, they had expected to find some kind of container or a wrapper or something that the medication, the oxycodone and the clonazepam would have been in. You know, typically these are kept in like
a prescription bottle.
A prescription bottle, or just even like a little container or something, what have you. There was absolutely nothing in the house, in the trash, in the medicine cabinet, in the trash that had been taken out. There was no container whatsoever that would have held these things. So that was suspicious. Like, what, you just like had loose pills in your cabinet? That doesn't make any sense. So the only thing they found was that cough syrup bottle. And then on November 7th, so this is the following day, Lloyd Amborn, who's the administrator of the medical examiner's office where Kristen worked, was notified of the death. And because of the sensitive nature of the case and how there was two people that were sort of connected to him that worked right in the office, he knew that there were rumors surrounding Kristen and Robertson and that nothing had been confirmed, but it was very obvious that there was something going on between the two of them. So he wanted to make sure that neither of them had anything to do with processing Greg's case, which was a very good call. Yeah. And so
conflict of interest a little bit.
Exactly. They wanted to just really keep things impartial and preserve the integrity of the findings.
Well, and especially if there was any sign of foul play and going to trial, then you don't want it to be...
You don't want that...
Tainted.
Exactly.
Inadmissible.
Exactly right. So when Greg's remains arrived at the ME's office for an autopsy and toxicology testing, there were pieces of skin that had been harvested, as well as both of his eyes. And the rest of his major organs, like I said, were intact, because the organ bank did not qualify him for procurement of these organs given the timeline of his death. So around 3:30 that day, the autopsy begins. Dr. Brian Blackburn...
Which Kristen still at this idea had no idea.
Had no
idea.
Time. Nope.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, she assumed that he would go for autopsy, but we'll talk about the things that she didn't expect. First, she didn't expect all of his organs to be available for testing, but there's more that she didn't expect. So Dr. Brian Blackburn performs the autopsy. There were a couple of unusual findings. So they found that his lungs were much heavier and more congested than normal. This is typically the result of a prolonged hypoventilation or slow and inadequate breathing. And secondly, his bladder was markedly distended with urine. So typically when these two things are found together, paints a picture of him having been unconscious and immobile for several hours prior to his death, probably 6 to 12 hours.
Okay.
Of him just laying there, being unconscious.
6 to 12 hours of slow breaths,
yes.
Not able to exhale and get rid mm-hmm. of that.
Right.
So that explains the hyperventilation.
Yep.
6 to 12 hours of urine being produced without being
him
relieved.
Voiding. Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Got it.
And that amount of urine that was found in his bladder would have been very uncomfortable for the average person.
Right.
Like, no one would just sit around, like, with that amount of urine in their bladder. Mm. So Dr. Blackburn also concluded that Greg had likely been dead for an hour, at least, prior to EMS arriving at the house.
Ah.
So this puts his time of death at probably somewhere around 8:30
okay.
p.m.
So almost 2 hours before he was actually pronounced.
Exactly right. So tissues from organs, blood, and urine were all taken for toxicology screening. Now, to further preserve the integrity of the testing, given the connection of the victim to the two employees at that facility, the samples were not tested for toxicology testing at this medical examiner's office.
Smart.
They sent them out to a neighboring lab.
Smart.
When Kristen got wind of this, she panicked because Kristen knew that fentanyl was not included in the standard toxicology screening for corpses that came in routinely to the San Diego Medical Examiner's
lab. But didn't know about the other lab.
But she didn't know about the other lab. It was actually more likely that another lab would test for them because that was becoming more mm-hmm. of the gold standard at the time. So she was likely counting on Greg's sample being tested at their facility.
And not being run for fentanyl.
Probably why she specifically selected fentanyl was for that reason. It's because she didn't think that it would be picked up on the standard tox testing. So. Hey, everybody, it's Kate from Med Crimes again, here to tell you about another great podcast I'm listening to. Three Spooked Girls is a twice-a-week true crime and paranormal podcast where they discuss a wide variety of topics, such as the Stanley Hotel, which is that really creepy hotel from The Shining, Japanese ghosts, Casey Anthony, which is getting a lot of national attention right now, Ed Kemper, Tamla Horsford, and more every Monday. They turn out so much content that there's something for everybody in here. They return every Thursday for a mini-sode from their Stabby Snippet series, which is always a true crime case told by Jessica or Tara. Along with the facts and advocating for the victims of the cases that they cover, the ghouls also love to bring laughs, themed drinks, and scares. Join Three Spooked Girls anywhere you get your podcasts. Follow them on social media under the handle Three Spooked Girls and Tara's TikTok for bite-sized content of cases and spooky topics as spooky_sleuth. That's Three Spooked Girls anywhere you get your podcasts. Subscribe today. Greg's family is also starting to become very suspicious of Kristen, and in particular, his brother Jerome, who had talked with Greg literally before, like right before
the
night before he died. He was really struggling to kind of comprehend how his brother could have possibly been considering suicide when he was actively making plans to go on vacation next month and literally ironing out these details, very future-oriented, and seemed happy. They also all struggled with the idea that Greg had abused painkillers or drugs at all, because he had no history
right.
of doing this at all.
Mm-hmm.
And his entire life, he had been such a good kid, you know, just wanted to help people, just wanted to do the right thing, and this just was not Greg. Like, they mm-hmm. knew Greg, and this did not happen,
yep.
according to them.
Yep.
So they were suspicious of Kristen specifically because they didn't necessarily know about her drug use, but they did know that their relationship was rocky. And Jerome even went as far as to call the police department and the medical examiner's office just to share his concerns.
Oh.
And be like, I just want you guys to keep this in the back of your mind because me and the rest of the family do not think it is remotely possible that he died by suicide. And like, please just consider this possibility. So right. he was doing everything that he could to make sure that everyone was aware. So
who knows how seriously they took that, though, too, you know, where they just, like, those brothers grieving doesn't know, you know, but.
And I think that's usually.
That's too much speculation.
That's under-respected, I think, as a whole.
I do. Is, I you know agree. What I mean?
Absolutely. Like,
but
in
you
general.
Can see how that is,
yes,
you know.
Yes, 100%.
See how they would respond that way.
100%. Absolutely. So, also, some of Kristen's co-workers are starting to come forward to the police and share some concerns.
Pardon my yawning.
Oh, yeah, no kidding. I want to yawn too, dude. So, when Kristen, Kristen's co-workers started coming forward and sharing some information about the relationship between Robertson and Kristen. So, the police are now getting wind that, like,
this has been going on for a while.
There's some shit, like, in the background here that we should really, like, investigate. So, Kristen had been advocating for having Greg cremated. For obvious reasons. But detectives acted very quickly and placed a hold on his cremation and were like, oh, fuck no. Do not cremate this guy until we say it's okay.
Until he's cleared.
Exactly.
By us.
So a couple weeks later, toxicology reports come back. He was found to have traces of oxycodone and clonazepam in his system. They were found to be at, like, therapeutic or subtherapeutic levels, so likely not enough to be fatal, at least at the time of the testing, along with massive quantities of fentanyl. Mm. Now, once the tox screen came back and Dr. Blackburn, the medical examiner, reviewed it, he determined Greg had died of acute fentanyl intoxication. So this was immediately suspicious because this was back in 2000. So fentanyl these days is widely available and easy to come across, like, as a street drug. But in 2000, that was not the case.
Right.
Fentanyl was really only used around this time in very select settings. It was used in hospice settings, operating rooms, emergency departments. That was really it. Mm-hmm. And it would have been exceedingly difficult for Greg to obtain fentanyl.
That much, too.
That much fentanyl on the streets. It was not a widely used street drug at the time. So, Kristen.
I wish that was still the case.
Yeah, no kidding. Wouldn't that be nice? Yeah. However, you know who would have had very easy access to, like, a shitload of fentanyl?
I do.
Devin knows.
I do.
Yes, you in the back.
Kristen.
Yep, it was Kristen. It was Kristen. So she would have had easy access to not just the fentanyl, but the clonazepam and the oxycodone.
All of it.
No problem. So detectives then call Kristen in for questioning. So she was grilled for a few hours. The lead detective in the case was Lori Agnew, and she did not initially mention to Kristen that she had the toxicology results back, but she did lay everything else out that they had, primarily all the circumstantial stuff and the evidence about their affair and her drug abuse history. And during the interview, she did admit to continuing to use meth, but that she was trying to quit. And after this line of questioning, you know, everything is still kind of circumstantial at this point. They don't have that smoking gun, so they did have to release her. And this was kind of the ongoing theme over the next few months. Lots of questioning, lots of circumstantial stuff, no smoking gun.
Trying to also see if they can get her to probably trip up, right?
Well, what they're hoping.
Trip up on her stories.
That's what they're hoping. This repeat questioning, that's exactly the strategy.
Inconsistencies.
So, right, exactly. So on November 26th, she was placed on an administrative leave from her job at the ME's office. And what happened was detectives had told her and Robertson's boss of the fentanyl that they found in Greg's system. And this immediately set off red flags with the higher-ups at the ME's office, and it triggered a huge inventory to be taken of the entire facility and the drugs. And a huge audit was done. And this is when they identified those fentanyl patches and then the fentanyl vials were missing. So during this time, Kristen is let go. While she was not working there anymore, Kristen initially, you know, freaked out, went on a drug bender and kind of spiraled out of control. She traveled to Mexico several times to get cheap fixes as she no longer had her office to steal from. And authorities, meanwhile, worked really hard to get a search warrant for Kristen's home, which they did obtain in January of 2001. She was found during this search to be altered because they entered without telling her, as they often do. She told Detective Agnew at the time that she had meth in the apartment, and she showed them where her stash was. Unfortunately, they had no proof that she had done anything to Greg, but they could arrest her for possession of methamphetamine, which they did.
At least got her off the street.
Right. In a poetic twist, she had called Robertson from jail for assistance, and he refused to help her.
It's because he's trying to save himself.
Well, he is.
It's a sleazeball thing, too.
Authorities are sniffing around at him, too.
Because, that's why he's trying. Yes.
Yeah. So she calls Robertson from jail. Please bail me out. He refuses because authorities had also executed a search warrant at his home. And he got nervous and decided to start distancing himself. Smart move, for once.
Smart move, yes.
Yes.
But, I mean...
Also sketchy.
He's still sleazy.
Yeah, well, God, of course he is. I'm not saying he's not. He's a wicked sleazebag.
Big ol' sleaze.
Big ol' sleazeball. These are some, like, really great humans that we're talking about here. Greg is a great human.
Best of the best.
But these two are kind of scummy. So... now, during this search of both of their places, computers and files were gathered from both their homes in hopes of uncovering some, like, search engine evidence or something like that. Kristen kind of pulled herself out of her little slump, weirdly enough, and the end of January actually began working again. She landed a job as an assistant chemist for a small biotech company, and... Of course, she hid that she was fired from her previous role and didn't disclose the current legal entanglements. But with the new job, Kristen again attempted to get clean, and she moved into a new apartment, and she tried to kind of put all these things behind her. She and Robertson did briefly rekindle around this time as well, but Robertson did soon kind of start to distance himself, though, because he had lost his job in all of this, too. Mm-hmm. He had not just... you know, kicked Kristen to the curb. They had kicked him out too. And he was troubled because, unfortunately, unless he found another job, he would have to return to Australia because he was there on a work visa. So, unfortunately, he was unsuccessful at looking for work. And in May of 2001, he ended up having to go back to Australia, abandoning Kristen completely. So investigators were suspicious of Robertson and felt that he was likely connected to Kristen's plans to murder Greg. But given that he had to return to Australia, there was very little that could be done to, like, bring him to justice, which is a huge bummer. And it really sucks. I hope something changes someday. Now, at this new
international
office,
stuff gets tricky.
Yeah, it does. It really does.
A little bit.
Now, at the new office... Kristen is bubbly, she's talented, she's everyone's best friend. Everyone there really, like, loves her and thinks she's just, like, a great person. Now, they execute a few more search warrants of her home and search, like, a few more times. All the while, she kept getting pulled in for questioning repeatedly, so she knew that it just, like, wasn't over. Now, investigators found that prior to Greg's death, she had Googled fentanyl a couple of times on her computer. So they did find that. That was suspicious. Finally, investigators pored over her case files when she worked at the ME's office. And they found that in Kristen's cases that she had, like, processed and documented, the amounts logged for the drugs versus the amount stocked, there was always a discrepancy in each one of these documents. So
that makes sense. We said this from the very beginning.
Exactly. And most of these were particularly with cases involving methamphetamine, and then most recently cases with fentanyl. So they were missing key pieces of evidence with, like, a whole bunch of cases specifically processed by Kristen. So this finding, coupled with the missing fentanyl from the office, was finally enough to charge Kristen with homicide.
Wow.
So, on June 25th, 2001, she was arrested for the murder of Greg DeVillers. And she pleaded not guilty to first-degree murder. Bail initially was denied, and she was not released. which of course meant that Kristen sat in jail for a long period of time without any drugs. So of course she went through methamphetamine withdrawal in jail, which must not have been pleasant at all, but she deserves 10 times worse. So for methamphetamine, withdrawal is most often characterized by agitation, depression, anxiety, tremors, insomnia, nausea, vomiting, hallucinations, and paranoia. And so she probably experienced all of that for several days, and I'm sure it was very, very uncomfortable. I'm like, no, good. I'm glad.
Yeah. Well, right. Yeah.
So the preliminary hearing occurs October 9th in 2001. And the case was drawing national attention at this time because of how theatrical the scene was.
Right.
And also how strikingly beautiful Kristen Rossum is. I mean, she's like gorgeous. So between the rose petals and then Kristen's beauty, the media dubbed this the American Beauty murder.
Oh.
Yeah. So.
Hence why you said the movie earlier.
Yes. And that's what it's known as. Yeah. And Kristen's family, in support of their daughter, started taking the media by storm themselves and trying to counteract some of the negativity surrounding Kristen. So they were like doing, you know, magazine and newspaper interviews, TV interviews, and they would be very outspoken about how Greg was actually the one that was spiraling out of control and using drugs and drinking heavily, and that he was unstable and controlling. And while Greg was like very passionate about maintaining his relationship with Kristen, the other stuff was a complete and utter bullshit lie. So I don't know if they were, you know, just trying to protect their daughter or if they truly felt this way about Greg and truly thought that Kristen could do no wrong, because they painted poor Greg in this very unflattering light, which
you is know, not who awful. He was.
No, that's not who he was. He was a great guy. Kristen did not deserve any bit of Greg. So
Greg did not deserve to stumble upon her in Tijuana.
No, he did not. No, he did not. Dealt,
you know, treated that way.
No, he was in the wrong place at the wrong time. It's very sad. So the pre-trial hearing begins, which is sort of where they decide, you know, is this going to go to trial? Does it have enough evidence? So, of course, Kristen's defense team is hoping to avoid trial altogether, but prosecution did a great job of highlighting the substantial motive she had to kill Greg, as well as all of the suspicious circumstances. Now, the judge ruled that the case would go to trial, but of course it would be several months, so she did get the possibility of bail at this time, and it was set at $1.25 million. And initially, prosecution wanted to seek the death penalty, but the DA knew that getting a conviction would be a lot harder if the death penalty was on the table. So the DA ended up dropping the death penalty altogether. And so they ended up just going for life in prison for murder one. So in the meantime, Kristen's family were able to post her $1.25 million bail and spring
her
from the
prison. That's right, because his dad was like the prominent job, so yeah, they had the money.
So they did have to put their house up as collateral, though, and they cashed in all of their retirement fund. Wow. So now Kristen gets out of jail and she returns to work. Her biotech company totally had her back and was like, yeah, you can come back to work. We don't believe any of that bullshit. We know you. Like, we know you wouldn't kill anybody. And, like, you know, just she is maintaining this front, you know, so well and just is so incredibly manipulative that this whole group of people just totally did not buy into any of that. So awaiting trial, prosecutors were poring over everything, trying to make sure that they could seal the deal, and they made a key discovery.
A key discovery. Yes.
So, December 1st, 2002, prosecution identified a receipt from the grocery store that day that she came home
with
groceries. When
she went to the grocery store to have lunch.
So, she had purchased soup, cough medicine, and a single long-stemmed rose. So this was finally concrete evidence that Kristen had staged the murder scene. Totally staged it. So the trial begins October 15th, 2002. Again, the media is all over this like white on rice. And there were weeks of testimony, cross-examination, and witness statements all building the timeline around when Kristen left her apartment, when she got back at work, when she was at the grocery store, that receipt being essentially that smoking gun that prosecution really needed. They also pored over Kristen's work case files and all those discrepancies there, and the drug inventory discrepancies, as well as all that missing fentanyl. And they brought up that it was evident during Greg's autopsy at the scene and the scene on arrival that law enforcement and EMS saw that Kristen never performed any CPR on Greg. They could tell that by autopsy. And
well,
by the scene.
I mean, yeah, especially if you're doing it right, you break ribs.
Yeah.
So if that's all intact,
yep.
You know,
there was nothing on the autopsy that indicated she had performed any sort of resuscitative efforts at all. And
she's a liar.
Yes. So, and at Rossum's trial, the prosecution called Dr. Theodore Stanley as an expert witness on the properties and characteristics of fentanyl. And this is really interesting. So Dr. Stanley testified that fentanyl, of course, is a potent and very fast-acting pain reliever. And he testified on the characteristics of fentanyl given in different methods, as well as fentanyl patches as well. And he testified that fentanyl begins to affect respiration at a concentration level in the blood of around 2 nanograms per milliliter. At a concentration of around 4 nanograms per milliliter, about half of opioid-naive individuals, or people without significant experience in taking opiates...
Like Greg,
would be breathing very slowly or not at all. So this is at a concentration of 4 nanograms per milliliter of the blood. And the concentration that was found in DeVillers' blood was 57.3 nanograms per milliliter.
More than 10 times the amount.
Yep. And
that would stop his breathing.
Dr. Stanley testified that no opioid-naive individual would be conscious or breathing or alive with that concentration of fentanyl. So I have no idea how many micrograms of fentanyl it would take to bring a blood concentration of fentanyl to 57.3, but...
A lot.
A lot is the answer to that question.
Oh, man. Thanks, Kristen.
Right? So, November 12th, 2002... the jury arrives at a verdict, and they found Kristen Rossum guilty of first-degree murder and sentenced her to life in prison without the possibility of parole.
Bye-bye.
She was transported to Central California Women's Facility in Chowchilla, California, where she resides to this day. And if you're wondering where Dr. Michael Robertson is... he is still living in Australia and working as a forensic toxicology consultant, and it's unlikely that his involvement will ever be completely understood or brought to justice. Yeah.
Right. Especially understood, because depending on how heavily involved he was.
Exactly. We don't know for sure.
I mean, maybe he does need to be brought. Maybe he doesn't.
Right.
Maybe
we don't know.
He's just a sleazebag sleeping with a married woman.
Mm-hmm. Pretty scummy.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And that is the story. A former toxicologist, Kristen Rossum, and how she murdered poor Greg, who was just the best guy ever.
What a story to tell around the holidays. Thanks, Kate.
You're very welcome. Anytime. I love bringing you guys down.
She's good for it.
I am.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. If you want to keep checking out and following us and hanging out with us, please go to Instagram and follow us at MedCrimes Podcast.
You can tweet at us at MedCrimesPC.
Tweeting is still survivable?
I don't know. Is that a thing anymore? I just don't even know. I'm not on Twitter much. I don't know if you can.
Search for us on Facebook at MedCrimes Podcast.
If you wish to become a Patreon, visit www.patreon.com/MedCrimes Podcast.
You can email us all your crazy stories, your awesome ideas, anything you want to say to us at medcrimes@gmail.com.
We will see you guys in January.
February.
Oh, we will see you guys in February.
We're not looking forward to the hiatus, as you can tell.
No.
We'll miss you. Have a wonderful early start to 2023, and see y'all in February.
Stay safe out there.
Bye.